right, everybody, welcome back. This is episode number 487 of the Whence Came You podcast. Right off the top, I want to thank the producers, fellows contributors, and our legacy partners for being a part and helping bring all this Masonic education to the masses worldwide. You may notice this is an episode that's a little bit different. We're recording the video of this one, kind of a special episode that I wanted to get together with our good friend and brother John Ruark of the Masonic Roundtable and other Masonic exploits. This week, we're going to talk to John, and we're going to talk about The Master's Word, a book that we put together. We kind of reissued a classic, added some stuff to it, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But before we do, I want to pass it over to John and say thank you so much for making some time. I know it's late over there in Virginia, but we were able to get together and get this interview going. So thanks so much, John. Tell us a little bit about yourself for those who, on the off chance, they've been living under a rock.
No, I appreciate that. Let's see. John Ruark, past master of the Patriot Lodge, number 1957, in the jurisdiction of the Grand Lodge of Virginia. And, yeah, just been a Mason since 2007 and have gone on a wild ride of traveling around and getting to meet lots of great friends and brothers over the years and learning a lot as we go. I think that's going to be the big theme about the conversation tonight. So, yeah, back to you.
Well, I can't thank you enough for making some time. I know we both, you and I, have together like a full kindergarten class for sure.
yes,
maybe a little bit older. Some are older, some are younger, but definitely appreciate your time. So let's just kick this right off. There's a book that I'll make sure we put a little blurb in here somewhere and some post-processing, but you'll see the book here, The Master's Word, a short treatise on the Word, the Self, the Word, the Light, and the Self. Sorry, I'm like looking back and forth at screens, new stuff. So basically this, to give you a little bit of history on the book, I first picked this book up when I was presenting at the Illinois Lodge of Research, and we were doing a small symposium out in Bloomington, Illinois. The Illinois Lodge of Research Library was there at the time, and I was just kind of going through the books as you do when you're visiting, and it was like on my break. I had just finished presenting, so I was like kind of decompressing. Let me go into the library, and I pull this book. And it's this little teeny book, and it said, The Master's Word on the spine. And I thought, well, that's really crazy because, you know, I'm obsessed with the idea of the word. And so I said, I got to pick this out and see what it says. You know, I've read Steinmetz and Krieger's. I've read, like, all these books on the word. What is this guy? And it was so small, I, like, literally thought I was going to sit there and just take a picture of every page and just go through it. You know, not unheard of. Some people think, that's crazy. I would never take the time to do that or whatever the case is. But here, I really thought about doing it. And if I was a lesser man, it's such a small book, I might have just opened my pocket and put it in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out I looked this book up when I came back home after I had all my snapshots. And I found a couple copies used. Obviously, original printings for like $500. And I was like, holy cow, that's crazy amount of money for that kind of thing. So I bought the next best thing, a facsimile reprint. And I'll tell you, it was awesome to be able to read the text. But what was not awesome was the amount of just bleed and bad stains.
Awful reproduction.
I mean, literally, this. I love these reprint companies, Kessinger and all these other guys, classic reprints, but because they are keeping these books alive, but they're also not doing any favors to the people who might really love the printed page. And I think the book itself is addressed to Rosicrucians and Freemasons whatsoever dispersed. I'm not a Rosicrucian. I've never been a member of, you know, a Masonic or like Amorc or an outside Rosicrucian order, very, very much interested in that stuff, but just have not taken that step forward in my philosophical career. And I think one of the things that was interesting was, I don't know if John, did you already know about this book, or was this something that I had mentioned that you like later looked into, or
so I think I actually first came across it after talking to you. So you really introduced me into this book. But again, when Robert says something, I go off and dive down deep and go down my own rabbit hole. And so I thoroughly enjoyed it. And what I enjoyed about it is that it was dense, right? That it was supposed to be a short treatise, but it's actually a very dense book if you start to read it, which is part of the reason why we wanted to take this on as a project to kind of unpack it and make sense of it in a modern era. And so it being a Rosicrucian, or written by a Rosicrucian with some Rosicrucian type themes in there, again, that was a bonus track for me. And so a little bit of history here. So Plummer was actually, or Plumer, I don't know how you pronounce his last name, was in the Rosicrucian order of SRIA, the Societas Rosicruciana in America. Which is not the same if you're looking today as the SRIA, which is in Anglia, which is kind of the more European or English Masonic Rosicrucian order. So what remains today in the United States is the SRICF, which I'm proud to be a member of. And so it's kind of like one of these things. I've given a copy of this book to family members who aren't Freemasons, who aren't Rosicrucians. The good news is there's no spoilers in there. There's really no secrets of either Masonry or Rosicrucianism in there. However, it's one of those, it's kind of like the bonus track to the movie. You've seen the movie, now you see the behind the scenes, you're like, oh, that's how they made, Neo do the bullet trick, right? So, It's icing on the cake, but it doesn't spoil the actual contents of any degrees. So when you have a title like The Master's Word, I've had people already that say, I'm not going to pick it up yet. So why is that? Well, I'm not a Master Mason yet. Like, well, that's okay, because this is not full of spoilers. But it gives you, what I like about this book is it gives you the philosophical structure underpinnings, lattice work, right, to help build upon anything you'll get in the degrees, or vice versa. After you go through the degrees and you're trying to make sense of how does that apply, both Masonic and Rosicrucian, and how does that apply to me? How does this apply to the real world? How do I make sense of it? It's a really good supplementary text to help you kind of navigate the philosophy behind Masonic orders, Rosicrucian orders, and the like.
Yeah, one of the things that I was really kind of turned on when I was reading the book is this kind of interesting idea that we see in a lot of the type of, so the book was written in 1913, and we see this rise of spiritualism as a full-blown religion toward the end of the 19th century, early 20th century. And Plummer, kind of strikes while the iron's hot, in that he creates this book, which has a lot of original great content in it, things that I see a lot of stuff that Manly P. Hall writes, and then later, like Max Heindel kind of picks from Hall, but then I see that where Hall has picked from people like Plummer and people like Milton Pottinger, who wrote a treatise on the soul, like in 1905. And so it's interesting to see this similar thread throughout the authors, and maybe what's valuable is picked up by the next person. And in that same vein of seeing what's valuable and like a reiteration of that thing is this theme that's in the Master's Word of archetypes of the masters who have been with us since, time immemorial. And Plummer lists out a bunch of them, but on the cover of the book, we've got Krishna, Ahura Mazda, the Buddha, and of course Christ. And then of course it enters into the human skull, right? So it's kind of this hidden symbolism there. in the book's cover. One thing I wanted to ask you, John, because you've got much more of an insight in this. I mentioned at the top of the show that I have no insight into the Societas Rosicrucia. Is it Civitatis Federalis, right?
Close enough.
Okay, close enough. My Latin is close enough, but as close as it's going to get, probably.
Yeah.
So with that, because Plumer's a Mason. He's a member of a Rosicrucian order. And then there's some conversations that happen about equity. And he likes this idea of everybody being able to practice Rosicrucian things. And so they create, he's one of the creators, I believe, of the SRI America, AM. And so within this, my question for you is, although the content of this particular book being SRI AM America, right, with what he wrote, is there an experiential piece of the text that's still relevant with SRICF, or is it wholly different?
Yeah, you know, one thing that I really felt honored to join the SRICF because it's an invite-only body here in the United States. It's something I may have said before on the Masonic Roundtable, but it is definitely scratching my esoteric itch and my philosophic itch, and even a little bit of my theological itch, because while being an invite-only body, what it does is it is unapologetic in its esoterics. So where some organizations may say, well, there's no esoterics in Masonry, or you're just looking for something that's not there, it's there, and that's one thing I was happy to finally see after going through this journey of being a Mason for many years prior to that. And so, what those things are, it's nothing that really another seeker of the light wouldn't stumble upon in its own way. It's just its own system, right? There's many other systems, like you said. There's even non-Masonic Rosicrucian-inspired organizations. This one does require membership to be a Freemason before you can join or be invited. And so, is there anything that's specifically Rosicrucian about this? No, with the exception that what I like is the emphasis on comparative religion, with that this book goes into a lot of themes, right? You're looking thematically across time, across creation, and across religion to find what is the religion that all men can agree on instead of all of the various nuances of your sect or denomination compared to mine, right? And that's, again, that's really the whole goal of Freemasonry, in my opinion, is that can we agree on those things that unify us together and get away from politics, religion, and all the pieces that divide men? So the fact that this treatise takes a very logical approach to, comparative religion, trying to find influences, trying to find themes across. It does a really good job of laying it out in a very simple way, again, dense, but logical way of saying how all things come together, of what is the light, what is the word, what is the truth. And it doesn't just get you to the answer. It would be a very short book if it just told you the answer, right? It tries to show you, there's a phrase I've heard, but there are many paths to the top of the mountain. And it tries to show you that, however, if you are, from Middle Eastern type religions, here's how that path could be interpreted. If you're from Far East religions, here's how that path could be interpreted. And again, you start to see commonalities across those. And so, when I try to explain this book to people who are either Masons or not, just to say, this is part book on philosophy, but also part book on comparative religion, which is a good virtue to have as a Mason and a Rosicrucian, because you want to make sure that you know what you believe. You want to make sure that you are tolerant of other religions, right? Because ignorance is what separates man as well. And so if you've never had a comparative religion course, this is a really short way to do that, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that's one of the greatest values in the book. Also, you learn a lot as you go along through the text. And you mentioned that, you know, that it's not a super long book. I mean, this book in its original text, I think, is 109 pages. You and I wrote this edition. We put it together, and I think we're at about 150 pages. And that is because you and I did some extensive annotating and footnoting of many different parts of the book. And so let's talk a little bit about that process. I mean, you and I both have come together to write It's Business Time. So there's another shameless plug for that book. Those of you out there who are interested in lodge dynamics and some of the best secrets that Fortune 500 and Fortune 50 companies have been using over the last 100 years or so to make business better. Those are all explained in that book right over John's head that he and I put together. And that was a lot of fun. But that was a totally different experience, right? You and I took our own experiences in business and we put it in a book and adapted it to a lodge. This book is wholly different in that not only did we bring a book back to life, we were Frankenstein's monster, right? Put the paddles on, brought it back to life. All new typeset. So we put everything in there. You know, we didn't just OCR it and let it fly to the printers, you know, willy-nilly with all kinds of weird grammatical errors that OCR would pick up. John and I went through with a fine-tooth comb here. But as a learning exercise, it was kind of interesting. I don't know, for me, personally, like as I'm reading it, you know, there are words that I was like, I'm a pretty average guy, so if I don't know what a word means, I should probably define this. So we would footnote it, and I learned a lot doing that, too. John, any insights on your end there?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's one of those, if you're going to read the text in its original 1913 condition, you're going to be writing these notes in the margins anyway. And so if we were going to take this on, well, then let's make this accessible. Let's do the homework of trying to figure out either the esoteric terms that he's using or just the terms that are anachronistic, that are, you know, terms that were popular in 1913, probably have faded into existence in 2021. So we wanted to make sure that we got the intent of the author across as well, right? So we did keep the text as close to the original as Plummer wrote it. So we didn't go back and clean up his grammar. We didn't go back and clean up his syntax and his punctuation. And that was by design. We decided up front, let's preserve the original text as it is, with older terms and all, so that you can view it as a snapshot in time. I think that was the effort there. So that way, while you can interpret this in a modern context, you know, over 100 years later, but at least you can see how the author intended it when as he wrote it. And then, you know, we wanted to clarify those things, not only, you know, the definition of terms, but also to get some context of what was going on. Because remember, this was written over 100 years ago. Science and technology have come a long way since 1913. And so part of the annotation process was to look at what did he know, what was quote-unquote modern science in 1913, because a lot of stuff hadn't happened yet. And I think one of the biggest ones, there's an entire section of how the life force is inside of blood and throughout all religions, and he looks at all these different religions, and they all have some sort of reference to blood being sacred and how blood is mixed, et cetera, et cetera. And so he goes on and comes to this philosophical conclusion that there's something in our blood that gets passed down to the next generation after us. both in a genetic sense as well as in a philosophical sense. And so this is all before the classification existence of DNA, right? So he didn't have DNA tests. He didn't know what DNA was, but we know now that it is, you know, the building blocks of your genetic code that makes you, you, and that, you know, gets passed on to your offspring. And so we added that context to it, which is a fascinating part, because you could tell he was onto something. He didn't have a name for it, but he could tell in a logical way, in a scientific way, and in a theological / philosophical way, there is something to our blood that makes us unique, that makes us have energy and life, and that you know, that does pass down. So I think that was a good example of how we preserve the original 1913 context, but added additional context as reading it, you know, going back in time in our DeLorean to go find out what he meant by that.
It just wouldn't be a good podcast with John Roark if we didn't mention Back to the Future, have a good reference there. I totally agree with you. I think what was really fascinating about the text and what I was learning as I was putting this together are some of the additional just little factual changes over time, too. As you said, a snapshot in time, it is interesting to note that some of what Plumer mentions in terms of, like, the populace of a certain part of a civilization who worships one type of religion versus another, you know, we added those, we updated those numbers in the footnotes. There are some words that meant things like cells or whatever, right? But it was like omisomes or something weird. I can't remember the exact word because it is, as you said, just totally anachronistic in its dialogue. And, of course, it's 1913. If those words were used today in a text, I would just accuse the author of trying to be a smartass. But,
right.
You know, in this particular text, I think this was just the things that they were using to describe those concepts in that day. And what is also interesting about it is that, like, one of the things that I found fascinating is I kept waiting to come across some part of the text that just didn't fit anymore, that you would find to be, I don't know, irrelevant or even if you read a lot of these older texts by some of these older esotericists, you find that there's even language in there that's kind of uncomfortable, maybe a little bit racial, you know? I know I won't mention the book, but, there, you know, Steinmetz and Krieger in their book have some language that's kind of, you know, I don't know, weird. In this book, I think Plumer's language shows that, at a minimum, he was a very open and liberal person. The fact that he was into the equity of, you know, studying Rosicrucianism and these kind of things was talked to his particular character, I think, pretty well. And
yeah, I think that's one thing I forgot to mention. I believe part of the reason why we don't have SRI America anymore is that they did start opening up the doors to women. And that became an issue at the time. And so it started to become either, you know, not recognized or just spun off into other, you know, splinter organizations. And so that's why you don't hear of SRIA in America anymore. But it stands to its character of that's like, well, this is for everybody, not just for men. So it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and the organization still exists today, and anybody in the whole world, Mason or not, can go join it. It's almost like, you know, AMORC or something along
right.
those lines.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you, you may have touched on it already, but as you were going through the text, what did you enjoy most about putting together a classic like this?
You know, just another thing that I really enjoyed as we were going through the process of annotation was looking up the biblical sources. So he spends a large section of time in the book talking about the science behind, you know, these concepts. He talks about the philosophy behind these subjects. And then he talks about, let's go find in the scriptures where these concepts are identified, not just Christian scriptures, but, you know, many other scriptures, but primarily, being from a Rosicrucian source, primarily Christian scriptures. And so, again, reading it with a fresh set of eyes, you find out that quotes and phrases that, unless you are an avid student of, say, the Holy Bible, you wouldn't pick up Rome right away. Or he'd say, you know, as Paul says, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, does he? Like, where does he say that, right? And so I thought it was also a worthwhile effort to actually cite the specific sources. Because he's, again, he's using the scriptures in defense of these concepts of the light, the word, and the self. If we're going to have this as a treatise to help people understand that, well, then it should be therefore easier to point right to the specific biblical source context to that. So to the greatest extent possible, we did go back and look at where these specific references were in the Old and New Testament, and that was very valuable for me just to you know, find the source and then also see where it fits in the context of that letter, that, you know, that gospel, et cetera. Okay. So I enjoy whenever I hear, you know, a Bible verse or something, I don't look at just the literal verse. I look at what's the text surrounding that, so I can see what's going on. What's the overall text trying to say, not just this one liner, right? Because we all know you get a 30-second soundbite on TV. It's way out of context from what the person originally said. So the same is true for biblical verses. And so if you're trying to set up the defense of his viewpoints, then you need to have the biblical text and understanding of how these all fit in. And so that's one thing I enjoyed putting together, because it makes it that much easier for the next person who's going to read it, that if they have a Bible or just, you know, Google right next to them, they can type in, you know, the specific Bible verse, hit enter, and now you can compare what you're reading from Plummer and the argument he's making, and then looking at it in the biblical context at the same time. And so that's something I enjoyed. I hope it added value, and really it just became another fun, like, Bible study project for myself too, selfishly.
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting to see, because as we were going through, you know, Secret of the Trade, right? It's the 21st century, so John and I just basically shared a doc and went through this thing. And so we got down to the nitty-gritty, and we had to format it for text, for print. And I would constantly see John in there just plugging the, you know, chapter and verse into the footnote. And I would go back and look at it and go, oh, that's fascinating, you know. It did really add so much context to the text, because
And think about how you get, this is post-Victorian, right, America, right? So this is industrial age, it's the turn of the 19th century. There was still a large religious undertone. Like, it was very common to be able to quote the Bible, right? So let's just call it for what it is. So at the time, it didn't make sense for him to cite those sources. Like, everybody knows what this verse means. Everybody knows where this came from.
Yeah.
In 2021, not so much, right? The people who are religious is going down. The people who, you know, practice and read biblical or any other religious text is going down. And so, again, it's also a little bit of a crutch to help those who maybe haven't dusted off their Bible in a while, that at least they can go find those sources pretty quickly as well. So without having to memorize it or anything like that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it was eye-opening. For me, my favorite part really was just waiting. I was playing this waiting game as I was going through the text going, when am I going to destroy one of his arguments?
Yeah.
When is science, modern science, going to just come in and go, ho-ho, wrong, you know, now just burn the whole book. I was waiting for it, and I was really hoping that I wouldn't find that, because it would mean that I really wouldn't feel comfortable releasing the book. I would have been like, you know, we got this far. I say we just strip everything out of it and release it the way it is.
Well, like,
I wouldn't have wanted to do it.
Yeah, and I know that is the lens you were looking through, just because I know that the guy that you are, you take your philosophy and interpret it through the lens of science, because it is a progressive science. We are learning new things through, you know, through experimentation and through rigor. And a lot of these concepts, you know, that we talk about, even to the divine, can be seen through the lens of science. And so I know that you enjoyed it because, again, there's a whole section where he talks about, you know, the science of this. And again, 1913 understanding, but when we found some things, there are only a handful, one, two, maybe three examples of like, yeah, science did prove this to not be true. And we added that in. So we're yep. You know, full disclosure, we didn't try to make it something it wasn't. We did correct Plummer when he was either wrong or had become wrong through, you know, updated learning. That happens, right?
Yeah.
I hope I'm proven to be wrong, right? Because that just means I'm human. But to your point, those times where he was quoting his quote unquote modern science to come to logical conclusions and they don't match the science today, they're minor, right? Those infractions are minor.
Very, very minor. And I have to say, you know, I was so proud by the end of the book thinking, I just can't believe it. I mean, having gone through it, like if you're footnoting something, you learn that text probably better than, I mean, it's like some, and then when I was formatting it for the print and for Kindle for people out there, again, I kept reading and over-reading and certain passages, and I was like waiting for something to not make sense. And then I would be like, oh, what's this weird old word? I would look it up, and then I'd replace it with the current word and go, that's still solid science. Like, I mean, it's just wild the amount of work and things that he must have put into the work and how well-read he had to have been on the forefront. I mean, the ideas that he promotes in the book are new, but he picked the right ones for the most part.
Right, right.
Yeah, so I think that was really fantastic. And as you kind of go through it, one of the things that I think I'll take away from the book forever is this idea that everybody has this ability to be special on, you know, in an esoteric sense, the divine level. This kind of idea of an inner Christ is really resonates with me. I think my mom, you know, she was kind of a New Ager she was always a Roman Catholic and a New Ager. I don't even know if those are compatible.
How does that? Okay.
Yeah, don't tell. And so growing up in a house like that, these were the things that I was always, you know, really exposed to. Kind of this liberal mindset, not in a political sense, but in a mindset of keeping my mind open at all times to all possibilities. And then, you know, that's why I do look at science and I go, well, how does science interpret this other thing? Right? Science is not just, it is nothing that's been invented. It's discovering a way to look at something to explain the natural world that is, you know, through our lenses. And I think Plummer does a great job of this also. But what I'll take away forever is his explanation of iterations of almost like superhuman consciousness and the way it kind of keeps coming into the world. If you wanted to think about it, it's almost like he wrote The Matrix before the Wachowskis.
Yeah, we're on the seventh generation right now, yes.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, this world around you has been created and destroyed several times. And so for Plummer, right, he talks about many iterations of this consciousness that comes along at a time when it's most needed. And that while he doesn't take away from the flesh and blood of the person, like of all of the characters within this text, right, the one that is most recent and closest to our living time today is He's Jesus of Nazareth, of the Christ. And he talks about him in this like most profound way, that he is the most, you know, elevated consciousness that has existed to our present day. And I think whether you're a Christian or not, the idea that most people can find really captivating here is not necessarily the same, you know, dogma as a Christian, but the idea of this elevated consciousness of the ideals of experience and being good and having this grace kind of idea. And that's what I really will remember forever from this book. And I was wondering if there was anything that stood out to you, John.
Yeah.
That's something that you'll always kind of.
Yeah, I want to double down on that, actually, because he calls it in the book the Christ ego. And so where it makes sense in this context is that he does use the scientific, the philosophical, and the scriptural interpretations to kind of come to the same conclusions. And so the goal is to find out which one's right. The goal is to say yes, and how do these fit together? So whether you look at things through other religious faiths, whether you look at things through Christ as the historical Christ who came and died, and then you look at it through Christ the archetype or the ego, the concept of Christ, the perfection of Christ, separate from the person, right? Whatever you want to look at it, he lays all the cards on the table. And so he's not trying to tell you which card to choose. He just says, here they all are, and you can make it with it what you will. But if you only look at it through a figurative way, here's one way to interpret it. If you're looking at it through a literal way, here's one way to look at it. And that aligns to you know, my interpretations as well, right? That, you know, right now I'm going through the five books of Moses that Robert Alter went through the original Hebrew and has added a ton of annotations about here's what the Hebrew meant, so be careful about how it gets translated over time. Again, that's another recommendation from you, Robert, and I thank you for that. And when you look at it, you find out that the Bible that has come to us today is a set of allegorical themes, right? And while there are probably people listening that are Bible literalists, you also have to acknowledge that when you look at the original source documents, they were specific words. Like Hebrew is a very punny language, for example, that you know, you choose words that sound the same to kind of give you a little funny context. And it's by design. It's by design of the people who actually wrote down that. And so so where I'm going with this is that it doesn't take away from the conclusion. And that's, again, something that I really enjoyed, is that he doesn't try to pick sides, right? He gives you all the options available and says, no matter which path you take, you're going to find some value coming through that. And so I like his approach, that it's not dogmatic. It's not prescriptive. It gives you options of how to interpret these very abstract concepts of what is light, what is word, what is the self. And another thing I want to add to that too is the concepts of three. You know, Masons, we love our number three. We do everything in sets of three. By design, he wrote his book to emulate that as well. So Masons will be very comfortable with this concept of Trinitarian beliefs, Trinitarian themes and concepts, and he uses all sorts of references to the light, the word, the self, you know, the body, the mind, the spirit, or the body, mind, and soul, wisdom, strength, and beauty. He goes through all these and shows them that, you know, these are three things that are separate, but together they are also one. And so he hits that theme in a Masonic context, in other religious contexts, in the Christ context, and so on and so forth. So I think it's he does a really good job. Again, another big takeaway for me is that he's consistent in his ability to lay out these options, lay it in a simple framework. I'm a big fan of frameworks because it gives you something to just hang your thought process on as you chew on it. And again, that's something he does very well.
Yeah, I have to agree again with you. This is not you're not going to hear me disagree with John in this particular episode because I think we both took a lot of wonderful things away from the text. Some stuff that I found interesting was also just diving into the times. Of course, we're all kind of familiar with the time that Plumer was alive. If you study, you know, any kind of late 1800s development of things like theosophy and the New Age movement and masonry and creation of things like the Golden Dawn and Hermetic Order of Golden Dawn, rather, and its kind of offshoots into the United States and all of these things. But you tend to find some things that maybe you wish you hadn't found out about certain guys and things that, you know, you just didn't know or whatever. And Plumer was an interesting character in that. If you visit the SRI America website today, they have a whole page dedicated to Plumer with just a mini biography and some additional things about his founding of the organization. And one of the things that was interesting to me was, you know, as he got older, he kind of got more acute in his beliefs about Christianity, actually. So where he starts off very liberal and kind of talking about Christ's ego and was a Freemason and things, later on in his life, he moved very much toward an Eastern Orthodox type of viewpoint. And from what I have been told, now I haven't done my own research on this yet, but from reputable sources say that he actually tried to take a lot of the Eastern Orthodox methodology and bring that into the organization. John, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do think it's fascinating to your point of having a broad spectrum of beliefs to then start to go in his later years into an Orthodox, Greek Orthodox context, which again, once you get into Orthodoxy, you have to be careful about, you know, which dogma you're going to follow, and which means, you know, not only what you are going to choose to do, but what you're going to choose to not do. And so, again, this book was written in 1913, when he's still big dog in the SRIA, and over time, 5 years later, 1918, he actually is consecrated as a bishop into the Reformed Episcopal Church, and then still writes a couple of things, but then fast forward to 1934, and he becomes reconsecrated into the Holy Orthodox Church in America. And he takes his seminary practice and goes back to all the same towns where all his Rosicrucian lodges were and starts spreading the good word later in life. So this is, again, you know, 15 years later or so after this book was published. I don't know if he renounced any of those things he said or right because he became more, you know, more conservative in that aspect. But either way, it's an interesting transition. You know, as we kind of say, you know, in other times, you can't unring a bell sometimes, right? You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube if once you like come to light. Here's another thing that, you know, your Masonic listeners will understand is, like, you know, after you understand what you went through your first 3 degrees, you see the world differently. You hear phrases differently, right? You look at architectural differently. You look at people and brethren differently because you have a different lens to look through. And yet, you know, so he was already, you know, looking through lots of different lenses, and then to slowly converge into one lens later in life, it is an interesting factoid about Plumer, the man.
Totally agree. Again, one of the things I wanted to pick up on is this idea of going back to all these towns where he had set up his Rosicrucian lodges. You know, the first thing that popped into my head was, you know, he's like the early 20th century Billy Mays, right? But wait, there's more.
Right.
Or wait, there's more. Hey, you listened to me before, now listen to me again. But he was really interested, really interesting in that aspect. I think it's probably a good time to kind of wrap this up a little bit, but I want to let everybody know, John, I really appreciate it when you check out this book. If you pick it up, we have it on Amazon and we have it on Kindle. People love it on both. I prefer print myself. I'm just saying it's a great medium. Plus, there's lots of margins for you to write in. John and I were very conscious about putting this book together and making sure that we tried to get citations and footnotes on the page that they were on. So you shouldn't have to go searching around.
Easier said than done.
Oh, my God. Yeah, laying that out is incredibly difficult, and I have a new appreciation for everybody out there. John put together at Business Time, and I didn't know what that entailed. I thought maybe just throw it in a Word doc and upload a PDF, and bada-bing, bada-boom, all done. Not so much. There's a lot of work that goes into that. So I have a whole new appreciation for the people who do this day in and day out. But I want to thank everybody out there for picking that book up. John, any closing or parting thoughts?
You know, we do appreciate everyone who kind of picks it up because, this is yet another labor of love that we have for the fraternity and for this specific text, right? It's not, you know, something to find at McCoy's. It's not something that you'll find at your normal Masonic bookstore. It really is a diamond in the rough, which is why we decided to spend a lot of time chewing over it. You've heard all the reasons why we like it and have appreciated it the more we got into it. And so, really, the last thing I'll add is if you like those kind of things, you're not going to find, you know, green bean recipes in here. You're not going to find Robert's Rules of Order in here. But if you want to find out the why behind what we do, what we stand for, what are the values and principles of being what being a Mason means, what being a religious person means, right? We're not telling you dogma. We're not telling you anything like that. We're just introducing another lens of what are those values and how do you interpret those? That's what I really enjoy putting this together. It is completely different from, you know, how you'll know me as the data guy on TMR or, you know, it's Business Time. Completely different because it really explores the philosophical side of why do we do the things we do? Why do we keep coming back to Lodge? How does studying and interpreting texts and comparative religion and all, how does that make us better people? Well, this is one lens to help you look through to get there. So that's, you know, if you like that kind of thing, you're going to love it. We know we did putting it together. And so, you know, one thing I'd also like to hear is like, if you read it, like send us a note, you know, hit us up on the Facebooks or the Gmails and all that. So we can just chat about it. Cause, there's a lot of really good discussion that could probably come from this. Even if you wanted to do like a little, you know, like a study group, a book club, this is a good one for a book club because there's so much to pull from. That he does a good job of taking these disparate religious systems and making this syncretic argument. And I mean, I think this could be something that you could certainly spark some really great discussions in Lodge or you know, over Zoom for your Lodge meeting. So thank you and check that out.
Yeah, I just would say same as John, if you guys are interested in plugging this out there, if you want to have John and I come out and talk about this book or anything like that, feel free to reach out. Please leave us reviews on Amazon. Those really help. Even if it's one star, we believe it or not, it's Business Time has a one star ratings. It has a great rating, but we do have a one singular one star rating.
You're not anybody until you get that one critic. Right?
That's right. So we appreciate all of the feedback there. I really hope you all enjoy the book. And John, I'll say goodbye, but for everybody else, stick around. We got a brand new Masonic Minute with Illustrious Brother Harrison coming right up.
July 1893, a young victim was rushed to Provident Hospital in Chicago with a near-fatal stab wound. The victim, James Cornish, was near death with the knife still stuck in his heart. Given the state of medicine in the late 19th century, the hospital staff did not expect him to live. Chief Surgeon Daniel Hale Williams examined Cornish and confirmed the staff's fear that Cornish had sustained an unsurvivable injury. Dr. Williams, a member of Most Worshipful Prince Hall Freemasonry, was born in 1856 in Pennsylvania. His father and grandfather before him had both been barbers. When Williams was 9, his father passed away from tuberculosis, and his mother, unable to support a family, left him with relatives. He was apprenticed to a shoemaker, but ran away and joined his mother in Rockford, Illinois. From there, he moved to Janesville, Wisconsin, where he followed in the footsteps of his father and grandfather, becoming a barber. He became fascinated with the medical profession, left his job as a barber, and became an apprentice to a local physician. Eventually, he was admitted to Chicago Medical College, now known as the Northwestern University Medical School. He opened a private practice, but was constrained by the fact that at the time, black physicians were not allowed to practice in public hospitals. A man of action, Brother Williams, after much resistance, founded and opened Provident Hospital in Chicago, the first integrated such facility in the United States. It was at that hospital the young James Cornish had entered without much hope of leaving alive. Assessing the situation, Williams realized the only hope of saving Cornish was to repair the wound in his heart. At that time, operations on the heart were not thought possible. Williams knew if he attempted cardiac surgery and failed, he would be subject to criticism and might even lose his license to practice. Nonetheless, he successfully performed the surgery. It was, in fact, the first ever open heart surgery. Williams' astonishing, almost miraculous feat was not acknowledged for another 6 years. But over time, he was recognized as the first surgeon to conduct open heart surgery. His feat becomes even more impressive with the realization that he did it without the assistance of tools available to modern surgeons, such as a heart-lung machine. Dr. Williams' career was fraught with racist attacks common in that day, and he knew other black healthcare workers faced the same issues. In order to address those problems, he expanded Providence's role as a teaching hospital and training ground for other black physicians. He also founded and opened the first African-American nursing school in the country. In 1893, Williams' notoriety led President Grover Cleveland to ask him to become chief surgeon at the country's first and most prominent hospital for people of color, Freedmen's Hospital in Washington, D.C. Over the course of his career, Brother Williams continued to spearhead projects to further opportunities for black healthcare workers, creating additional hospitals that admitted African Americans, working as a professor of clinical surgery, and co-founding the National Medical Association for African American Doctors. In 2001, Brother Williams, who died in 1931 at the age of 75, was honored as one of the 100 greatest African Americans. And as for James Cornish, the man who would have died had Dr. Williams not made the bold decision to perform that first open-heart surgery? He lived for an additional 50 years. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
Well, I'm glad you stuck around to check out this week's Masonic Minute with illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison. If you like what Stephen L. Harrison puts together for us and you liked that video that you saw or whatever you heard if you were listening to the podcast version, I do have to say please check out the bookstore because on WCYpodcast.com, the bookstore is there and it has a listing of all of the books of the people who have been on the show, including illustrious brother Harrison's books. Things like what he talked about this week, the first ever open-heart surgery by a Prince Hall Mason, things like this are just so fascinating and really interesting. And if you like that, then check out his books, Tales from the Craft, but he has a number of other books that he's written and edited. One of my personal favorites is, of course, Freemasonry at Oak Island, but Tales from the Craft is up there too. So I want to thank you guys for checking that segment out. And if you hear from Brother Steve or you see him online, be sure and tell him thank you for all that he does for this fraternity. And, of course, we thank him as well. Now, coming up next week, we're going to go ahead and get right back into Ancient and Modern Initiation with Joy. That'll be audio-only podcast again. And that's it for this week. So I want to thank you all for coming with me on this little adventure, kind of doing a new thing where we've got some video going on every once in a while with our guests. And, so once again, thanks to our producers, our fellows, our contributors. And, of course, a thank you goes out there to everybody who's picked up a copy of The Master's Word, a short treatise on the Word, the Light, and the Self. Again, we'll have links back to where you can pick up that book in the show notes. And I hope you guys really enjoy it. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.